What's going on, everybody? This is Patriot Underground here. Now, before we start the show tonight, I just want to say a quick word on behalf of my partners over at PatriotUndergroundGold.com and PatriotUndergroundSilver.com. I don't think I have to remind everybody the amazing movement that we've seen with gold and silver prices. Now is the time. You still have the opportunity to capitalize on the transition into the new system, while at the same time having that peace of mind of knowing that all of your hard-earned wealth that you've worked your entire life for is going to be safe and secure while this transition occurs. And certainly, regardless of what you believe, whatever your projections are about the future, we can look to the past historically, and we know for a fact that gold and silver have always been a store of wealth during uncertain economic times. And let's face it, folks, that's exactly where we're at right now. So click the link in the description, PatriotUndergroundGold.com or PatriotUndergroundSilver.com. It's time to make the move, folks. Get off the fence. Do the right thing. Click that link in the description. All right, everybody. God bless and Godspeed. Thank you for listening. Patriot out. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Patriot Underground. Today is May 6th, 2024. Thank you so much for joining me, folks, to discover the truth beneath the surface. As always, I really do appreciate everybody out there taking the time to listen. So today, it is my pleasure to welcome the great SG Anon back to the show. Certainly, he is no stranger to this audience. This man is an avid researcher. He's just an incredible source of information on all topics related to the Great Awakening, which he articulates brilliantly on both his own platform, the Q News Patriot, and on a wide variety of other podcasts where he is in constant demand for good reason. So it's an honor to have him back to continue our ongoing conversation about everything that we're facing and to hear his top-notch analysis. It is great to have you back, SG. Welcome.
Thank you for having me back, Patriot. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Well, let's just go ahead and dive right in. I think we've got a little bit over an hour to work with today. So I thought we could begin our conversation with a little bit of analysis surrounding the question of presidential immunity. And certainly there's been a lot of speculation about the various different court cases facing Donald Trump, all of which we know are complete and utter shams, of course. And I think you'd agree with me that this is all political theater, not only to prompt more people to wake up to the two-tier justice system, but also to provide a necessary distraction for all the various different military operations that are continuing to play out in the background. And you did a really great job highlighting that point in the context of all the trafficking and the pedophilia arrests conducted recently by Department of Homeland Security. But I wanted to discuss the issue facing the Supreme Court, which was argued, I believe, back on April 25th. Now, I will say that I have long anticipated that we would see a January 6th trial play out, primarily as a means to red pill the population as to exactly what occurred during election 2020. And you'll recall that both Trump and his attorneys have alluded to the submission of classified military evidence as a defense should these cases go forward. And certainly the entire framework of this lawfare emanating from what is clearly a weaponized judicial system hinges upon whether or not Trump was accurate when he made claims repeatedly that the election was stolen, which clearly it was. And we were also told that the trial would be live streamed, which would certainly provide a unique opportunity for the entire world to have their eyes on this spectacle and thereby permanently shift public consciousness, particularly as it relates to the gaslighting of the mainstream media and what they claim to be a conspiracy surrounding how the will of the people is repeatedly circumvented by highly coordinated and sophisticated election theft. And certainly a Supreme Court ruling against presidential immunity would provide a powerful legal precedent to go after previous presidents and to function really as a mechanism to reverse the brainwashing of the public. So suffice to say, I was rather surprised to hear the justices indicate that they're leaning in the direction of upholding executive privilege and immunity. And it seems to be the general consensus at this point, based on what I've seen, that we're probably going to see the Supreme Court fire a silver bullet, I guess, that would essentially kill all of these cases and clear a path to run for Trump to run unencumbered, while simultaneously eliminating speculation that some sort of legal mechanism would be used to remove him from the race. So having said all that, give us your thoughts on how you see this playing out in the days and weeks ahead and the implications moving forward pertaining to how the court rules on this issue.
Well, you know, Patriot, I got to say, that's a heck of an opening salvo for a question if there ever was one. And I think some of the finest judicial minds and jurors out there throughout the entire Western world are really analyzing and attempting to crunch what the Trump trial, specifically the one regarding privilege and executive privilege before the Supreme Court, actually means for U.S. executives and for how the constitutional system of government here in the United States is actually supposed to function. I can only speculate because I'm not a legal scholar, but based on the counterintelligence landscape that we've seen play out over these last many months and really into a number of years at this point, I would be surprised if the Supreme Court upholds a blanket executive privilege. However, I have begun to think more and more that the Supreme Court may uphold executive privilege and may term, executive privilege and presidential immunity as a constitutional functionality of the office, and may simultaneously outline when exceptions to that rule are and are not constitutionally permissible. For example, if a United States president orders, excuse me, the United States military in an unprovoked, non-defensive fashion to attack another country that is not engaged in hostile activities towards the United States, either covertly or clandestinely or overtly, then you have a backdrop, for example, where a war crime could be committed. Now, this is a hypothetical speculation, but it's not unlike what Hussein Obama and George W. Bush did to the Middle East, Northern Africa, and a number of various other second and third world nations around the rest of the world, right? When the dollar and the manipulation of the U.S. financial markets and access to U.S. resources wasn't enough, then the bludgeoning hammer of the United States military was used. So, in the same vein, I think that we do have to acknowledge that presidential immunity is important for exactly the reason we're seeing right now. We do have a system, be though as it may, that it's a two-party system and it's not a perfect system, but we have a system right now where it's sort of a pendulum swing between power. We have a power shift one way and a power shift the other way. This is the ideal understanding, right? This is the facade that has been created through MK Ultra. And so if we're going to try and realize that, then we have to realize that and truly bring that about in a way that discourages that type of manipulation, discourages that type of attacking of the opposition side, especially in an off season or in an off period, solely on the basis of ideology, solely on the basis of adherence to one side or another, right? So in that fashion, I think the commander in chief is absolutely right. The commander in chief must be able to make decisions in the moment that may or may not be morally permissible if we were to engage in a 2-hour philosophical debate. But when seconds, when seconds count, it's sort of very difficult to gauge what is and is not appropriate when you're talking about the defense of the nation or the defense of other U.S. interests around the rest of the world. However, I really do think that we're living through a time, Patriot, where questions are being both created and then answered in the judicial and constitutional scholarly space about what is permissible and not permissible. The current commander in chief, if we were to say commander in chief in the public normie sense, would be this installation known as Joe Biden, who all of us know is a Manchurian candidate. So in the normies' understanding of the world, what we have right now is the wrong man, because it's obviously not the real Joe Biden. We have the wrong man in charge of the military forces of the United States of America. That is a situation that is rife, or excuse me, is prime for extreme malfeasance and extreme criminal activity, quite frankly. And we've seen various behaviors sort of spawning right along in those lines, coming from this administration and coming from the Pentagon for the last couple of years. And Q said it had to be this way. And I firmly believe the military infiltration component is one of the reasons that we couldn't just stop everything in 2020 and immediately right our boat. So moving through this process with Trump, I think that we are going to see the Supreme Court either outline cases where immunity is not applicable or return that question back to the lower courts and instruct them to decide when cases of immunity are applicable and when they are not applicable, right? When we're talking about genocide, for example, and we can categorically prove that that has occurred on behalf of a nation state, should that nation state's head of state or head of military forces be exempt from international, law and order and justice? And I think the question that's implied in there is how interfaced do we have to be worldwide in a legal sense for our personal individual sovereignty at a nation state level as a responsible caretaker and a director of whatever that nation state is doing. At what point are we no longer allowed that privilege under our own laws because we have violated some other nation or some other culture group to such a degree that it's no longer permissible. This is sort of implicitly the question, ironically, Patriot. This is the same question that I think is going to get asked publicly in a very short period of time, of a short time frame, moving over the next year or two, as it pertains to the COVID bioweapon, Operation Warp Speed, and the various nation state heads of state that were involved in the rollout of a biological pathogen agent that they had no idea was actually rolling out in that fashion. And that narrative has already been sort of created and seeded a lot around Operation Warp Speed, with various individuals across bureaucracies, military institutions, and others that are confirming that information was withheld from Trump at every turn. So I think in the same fashion, this is the other side of that coin. Where is immunity appropriate? When is immunity applicable to a very serious criminal act because intentionality and motive and predetermination were not there, versus when the opposite is true? At what point do we say the immunity clause has to be suspended? This is the, I think, the basis of the entire discussion before the court. And I know it's a big discussion. That's why I said I'm not a legal scholar, because it's just a lot to take in and crunch. But I do think at the end of the day, the court is going to set a precedent to either establish what is an exception or not to immunity, or to direct the lower courts and the lower circuits to decide that on their behalf within their localities.
Okay. Now, really quickly, before we move on, are you of the opinion that the Supreme Court justices are under white hat submission? And if so, do you think, and of course, this is speculative, but do you believe that we are going to see this trial play out, this big spectacle with a live stream, with all the eyes of the world watching, so that they can disclose all of the evidence that we know that the military has? Or are you thinking more it's going to be like that silver bullet, let's just go ahead and kill this and clear a path for Trump and eliminate any speculation that he's going to be removed from the race? What does your gut tell you?
You know, it would be pure speculation on my part, Patriot, and I want to preface that for the audience out there, but I just don't think that the deep state component of this war, and that includes individuals I think are in submission playing a particular part, I don't think that they're going to allow Trump to go to the election in an unencumbered sense. I think we're going to see attempts get very kinetic to remove him from the race, potentially even try to put him in jail.
Okay.
This is one of the reasons where Q, or one of the reasons why Q came out and said any suggestion that the president is in danger or anything like that is false, because he's
right,
receiving 24-hour surveillance and security coverage. And I think this is a reminder to patriots that things get really hairy in a counterinsurgency operation, and sometimes we have to go deeper than we anticipated, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a constant dynamic situation. Everything is a design, redesign, and that's just the nature of warfare. You never really leave the strategy table. And so, excuse me, coming back to Trump and the decision before the Supreme Court, I actually think that both of your suggestions there are sort of true in a sense. I think that we are going to see a televised trial either being argued before the Supreme Court or being argued in the applicable circuit where Trump is having to deal with this January 6th election insurrection charge and yada, da, da, da. I think all of that is going to be televised. And at the same time, I don't think that it's going to provide the basis to keep Trump from being interfered with, if you will. I do think, however, that what you will see occur and what you will begin to see happening in the normie population is an open admission and an open realization that the behavior of the courts and the administration, the current Manchurian administration, and what is actually factually true about the 2020 election, they don't add up. And I think you're going to see the deep state side, and that includes, excuse me, individuals that are in white hat submission, because we've got pawns that we took off their board and replaced with our pawns, right? Q confirms that when Q says infiltration works both ways.
That's right.
And so that deep state side, that opponent side, I think is going to escalate it to the level where it's beyond salvageable, at the same time that the public is getting a steady drop in discourse of what actually happened with the 2020 election. And this may come actually back to the Supreme Court, Patriot, before it's over. The Supreme Court could punt some of these issues down the road and then consolidate them for the July or October session. We really don't know what the court's going to do. And also, on an ancillary fashion, to answer your question a moment ago about courts and justices and participation in the plan or not, I absolutely believe that some of the justices have been contacted by the military and asked to be involved. I do also believe that there are other justices that have not been contacted and are just simply acting in concert with what they perceive to be the unusual and extraordinary post-COVID landscape that is the behavior of the Supreme Court. So, you know, this is a fluid, I think, situation. In the same fashion, I don't believe every member of Congress is aware of continuity of government. I certainly don't believe every member of the Biden-Manchurian administration and all of its feeler arms are aware that there is a continuity operation taking place. But I do believe that some of them from all three of those camps that I just highlighted are aware of it, and that it is not in their interest to divulge that to the public or to each other.
Okay. All right. Well, that's really interesting information. Okay. So let me dig in a little bit more to this Trump jailing attempt, because you mentioned it, and actually this was going to be my next question. This was something that you touched upon in your last show. So let's just take a couple of minutes to discuss whether or not it's likely that we're going to see a jailing attempt in a little bit more detail. And I'm sure you're aware that just today, what's the judge? It's not Engoron. It's, I can't remember his name.
Merchant,
yeah. Held Trump in contempt for his quote unquote gag order. And I love the double meaning that you pointed out in your last show as far as that goes. But he, of course, threatened Trump with a quote unquote jail sanction if he continues to post on social media about the trial. And, you know, to me, I happen to think that this is another scene in this pantomime, to just yet another calm to patriots, this whole gag order and this, you know, this attempt to jail Trump and so forth. But putting that aside for just a moment, how do you think, first of all, do you think that it's really likely that we're going to see Trump actually spend time behind bars? Because, you know, he did say, and you mentioned that, well, you brought up Q a moment ago telling us that the commander in chief is insulated. But Trump actually said that he would gladly be a modern Nelson Mandela and he would run from jail if necessary. So do you really think that they're going to go for this and put him behind bars? And if so, how do you envision the general public reacting to these, what I would consider to be optics? And I think you would probably agree with me, but still in all, there would be a massive backlash to this. I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that, if you could dig a little bit deeper for us.
You know, my thoughts on the Trump jail attempt, and I do believe it is coming, is that it is going to mark the next phase of significant operations, both from an information warfare status, but also a status of creating the scaffolding for the catastrophic national emergency situations, which actually happened 2018 to 2020 here domestically in the United States homeland. Mm-hmm. Set up with more than 20 years of preparation and planning, right? But they're actually being realized now in the time and place that we're living. And part of that, it runs in tandem to the Great Awakening also. People are realizing simultaneously, sort of along in the same linear time frame, that COVID-19 was a bioweapon, that the vaccination campaign was a depopulation agenda, that mm-hmm. genocide really is, excuse me, being committed by multiple parties around the rest of the planet, not just in the civilian space, but even in the militarized space as well. And here we are in 2024 thinking that we've got it all figured out. So at the same time that's all happening, you've got this this period of realization into these emergency conditions that I think are being driven by a highly irregular and unusual military operation. And so I think the deep state is aware of that. I think when FBI went in to Mar-a-Lago in, I believe it was 2022, and, you know, made that whole big raid and the whole show, excuse me, and everything. I think they were going after documents regarding continuity of operations. I think that they did not find them there. And so the Trump trials and the entire Trump legal situation, not only has it been an operation to awaken people to the corruption of the judicial system, but it has been a very real in your face to the deep state opponents that the what I would call a patriotic military alliance is facing down, because we're conducting the theater and the theatric operations utilizing individuals that are in submission and individuals that are not in submission, who are just selfishly motivated and completely ideological maniacs. Yeah. And we're enabling the not only the mass awakening, but also the emergency conditions to begin to emerge here in the United States of America that destroys the ability of that deep state monstrosity to maintain constitutional authority. And that's the kicker in all of this, is we're having to work within the confines of the Constitution for the Republic of the United States and the U.S. code and the U.S. law that's not repugnant to the same. And there are actually portions of the law that are repugnant. So you have to go through and operate within a sovereign, legal framework, not in a state of argument, but in a state of acceptance. And that's part of what has been happening with these Trump trials. And the acceptance component, I think, is what Trump highlighted. I will gladly be another day Nelson Mandela. That's what he stated, a modern day Nelson Mandela, on his Truth Social post that day. And that post was one of the posts I used to reference some of the decodes in File 74, because I believe that we are going to see a public attempt made on, made to jail Trump, whether or not Trump will flee from jail, whether or not Trump will simply disappear from public view and be otherwise protected and secured by special operators. These are the questions that I don't think anyone can really truly answer. But one of the things that I think is fascinating is that Q 3716 and 3717 were the exact same drops sent at the exact same identical timestamp down to the 1 second mark. And the drops decoded regarding the arrest, the first arrest and indictment and things like that, as having been focused at the 45th president of the United States. And 503 came up, in the timestamp of that decode as well. And the 503rd Military Police Unit is a special operator capable military police law enforcement unit that serves at the behest of U.S. Army Special Operations Command. And JSOC, along with Army Special Operations and Air Force Special Operations, are the two primary overarching brainchilds, if you will, for the entire continuity operation that we're currently living through and the coordinated worldwide component of the same. So when we're talking about this possible Trump arrest, we have to remember that this is actually legitimately part, or could be part, I should say, of a much broader international military cooperative that is trying to destroy the nodes and the nexuses of transport and travel and all the escape routes that these slugs and cockroaches have been taking out of various jurisdictions to continue getting away with criminality for hundreds of years. And if we have to move into a position here in the United States where we interfere materially, publicly, profoundly with the electoral process by jailing a political candidate, the leading political candidate of the opposition party and a former president of the United States of America, in order to drive that military operation worldwide further along, I think that that's not only to be expected, but I think it's a great honor to do that. And quite frankly, I think President Trump is aware to some degree that he, in this process, may have been asked, to sacrifice everything, including his own personal freedom optically, just to get the American people into a mindset and into an understanding, a realization, if you will, that the process of free and fair selection in our great United States of America has not been true since at least the days of immediately after the U.S. Civil War.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. And, it really kind of raises that fundamental question of, are we watching a scripted movie or is this a fluid situation? So I'm going to pitch a question at you along those same lines, even though I think you've sort of started to flesh out this general idea about some individuals being under submission, other individuals just being basically puppeteered by their own narcissism. But this is really a fundamental question, the optics of this asymmetrical warfare. Now, it's clear that you and I both agree that we've been operating under COG for several years at this point. And to me, that consequently begs the question, how much of what we're seeing play out on this surface level is organic versus, shall we say, contrived elements of a script? And certainly there were many, many references, as you're well aware, of movies and watching a movie, and you could probably quote the drops a lot better than I could, but certainly the whole concept of theater in one form or another is a major, major theme in the Q drops. And certainly we've touched upon this in our previous conversations, but I have to say, in my recent reflections and my analysis, I've been gravitating more and more in the direction of interpreting this informational avalanche that's cascading at us every single day as scenes in an intricate pantomime, primarily to serve as a distraction while these covert operations to deconstruct what remains of the enemy infrastructure and personnel continue to play out in the background. And of course, as I already mentioned, in order to essentially wake people up. And no doubt we've seen an enormous amount of evidence that this is the case. In fact, I would argue personally that just about every event that we've seen, that we've lived through, raises pretty significant questions as to who's pulling the strings behind the scenes. And two recent examples which come to mind are the Key Bridge collapse and the raid on Diddy's compound. I know you talked about that in your last show, but there's always this speculation. Is it the deep state? Is it the White Hats? That's really the fundamental question that so many people are asking whenever a new event happens. So the relevance of this topic to me can't be overstated, considering that each and every day, all of us are faced with exercising our discernment, not only to interpret the events as they unfold, but also to keep our consciousness and our emotional balance amidst all of this chaos and all this fog of war. So with that being said, my essential question here was, do you believe, fundamentally speaking, that we're watching a movie play out versus being actively engaged in a fluid situation? But having heard your previous commentary, it sounds like you believe that's somewhat of a hybrid. So I was hoping you could maybe clarify that for us a little bit.
Well, I appreciate that question, Patriot, because it's been a long time since I've been asked that particular question. And at the end of the day, you know, I think what we're living through is a multidimensional espionage war that is magnitudes deeper and more complex than anything that we've ever been taught, save out of the finest military academic circles. You know, I've got a pretty good background in clandestine operations, understanding those things. I didn't take part in them, but, you know, cryptology, clandestine warfare, espionage warfare, these are things that I've studied academically and intellectually very hard for a long time. And it's difficult, I think, even for me to try and put, you know, a good picture, a good answer to the landscape that you just described. Now, that being said, I believe that we do have a hybrid situation. I believe that we've got individuals who are absolutely in submission, acting on behalf of a broader operation, being sworn to secrecy through device implantation and kill switch operations. I also believe that you have individuals who are not privy to these sorts of things, but that are driven by their own personal ideologies to either be on the side of humanity or on the side against humanity. And given the right construct, they will maximize and amplify whatever that side is. A good example of that would be Senator Rand Paul. I have no idea if Rand Paul is aware of a broader continuity of operations mission or not. What I do understand, however, is continuity of operations or not, Mr. Paul is extremely dialed in on the COVID-19 crimes, the pandemic, the crimes against humanity that were committed by the gain of function research, you know, funded by the NIH. And so this is a man who, given the correct operation format within the government, not being stifled by various committees and et cetera, this is a man who is willing to go to the legislative body, the public record, and enter these things in and fight for we the people. And in the same fashion, you have others on the other side, like Raskin, for example, who I think are just ideological maniacs, and they're driven by their own narcissism and their own disconnection to reality. And so they are also advantageous to let them run amok in the landscape of the espionage war, because they provide catalyst for that awakening process, covering fire for clandestine operations that may be happening, and also validation for all of the rest of the social circles and professional circles that they run in, that things truly are, quote, hunky-dory. And I'm using air quotes on that.
Yeah.
So I believe that that's the hybrid component, is what I just described there, right? You have individuals that are aware and can never admit it or even hint at it or ever acknowledge it. And then you have other individuals who I don't think are aware, but who are being essentially manipulated by the broader condition of the landscape to act in an amplified form to whatever their true, you know, alignment with humanity and alignment with we the people really, really actually is. And then the third angle of this discussion, Patriot, are those opponent forces, those opposing parties and powers that are fully aware of who they are, fully aware of what's going on in the world, fully aware of the activity that they've been committing and the criminality that they've been participating in. And they are simply seeking to manipulate the landscape for as long as humanly possible in any way that they can to try and stave off the inevitable. And I believe the main fundamental difference between that operating modality throughout the decades, where they have had unfettered power and total control, and the operating modality now, is that they're seeking attempts to delay and to stave off the inevitable are now, for the first time in history, being disrupted by a broader special operation, which is forcing them out into the light by manipulating those other parties that we just described.
All right. Absolutely brilliant answer, as usual, SG. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about election 2024. Now, clearly, there's been a lot of speculation about this forthcoming election. And as you recall, you and I have discussed on multiple occasions the likelihood of an emergency broadcast prior to November. And we've been in agreement, essentially, that it's unlikely that we're going to be going to the polls, at least under what we would consider to be normal circumstances. But the deeper we get into this year, and the more we're seeing what remains of the deep state run their known playbook, the more folks, I think, are questioning the implications if the vote, in fact, does move forward. Now, certainly, if Trump were to be elected, then on one level, of course, we would all celebrate that and consider that to be fantastic news. But on the other hand, those of us who have been awake and aware these past several years and a part of this movement, I think for us, it would raise some pretty significant questions about the way that this process is playing out, particularly in terms of arriving at justice for the most horrific crimes ever perpetrated on humanity. We're talking about, I believe it's pretty close to 500,000 sealed indictments that need to be served. And we're expecting, and certainly I've also heard that up to 99 people can be listed in one indictment. So we're talking about potentially millions of people. And personally, I think that if another election is stolen and we don't see, I mean, God forbid, we don't see intervention immediately, that it wouldn't bode very well for our movement, which, as I understand it, has always been intended to avoid the circumstance of ordinary people having to engage in kinetic fighting for their freedom, to push them into that zone where we feel like we've got no other choice. Now, believe me, I don't think this is going to happen, but I'm just throwing this out there as, you know, as a potential. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on where you stand in terms of your previous assessment about intervention prior to the November election, and also the implications of the vote moving forward, should that end up being the case, especially given the fact that, if we're being honest, a lot of our previous expectations haven't met up with reality. And there are a great many people out there, patriots, great, wonderful people, but yet they're struggling more and more each day to maintain their faith, their optimism. And certainly, I mean, we could go on and on from an economic standpoint. I mean, people are suffering in various different ways. So I'm curious if you can kind of give us some updated commentary and analysis on the EBS and whether or not you still are pretty solid in your assessment that we're going to have some sort of a interruption prior to the election.
You know, first off, I want to clarify that, you know, this is a fluid discussion, and this particular topic is one of the more dynamic and influx topics. I do believe, my own personal assessment still, that, and this was initially taken in February, March, that we're not going to arrive at a standard electoral process here in the United States of America. However, I also have made allocation and allowance for the idea that this is a fluctuating dynamic event worldwide, that the domestic politics of the United States are in fact involved in broader foreign implications at that international level. And so we may have a season that is extremely chaotic, but without a lot of overt, you know, activity from the deep state that would allow that type of expanded emergency condition that we're talking about, a terrorist attack, a financial crash, things of that nature. Now, one of the things, Patriot, that I think is really, really interesting on this entire discussion, and this is why I highlighted that it is a fluid discussion, is that the financial world and the implications of what's happening in the finance and banking and you know, value exchange systems worldwide is directly correlative, I think, to the progress of some of these worldwide military operations that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Liberating the ability for humankind in all of our respective nation states to print, standardize, asset back, and then, excuse me, ensure and guarantee our own currency and monetary supplies, thereby ensuring that our economies are insulated and protected. That is a huge, huge part of everything that we're living through. Mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve System and the central banking model over the last 500 to 1,000 years, the main primary component of those operations was to destroy national sovereignty and the ability of peoples that felt they were independent to actually be and operate as independent and autonomous states. In fact, the United States is a good example of that. We've thought that we were independent and the greatest nation on earth since 1872, and yet we've not been free really since the days prior to the United States Civil War. So in the situation now where we've got this election before us in this season of uncertainty, the financial changeovers that are happening worldwide have been happening for a while continue to press forward. The BRICS nations continues to add more impactful, excuse me, and resource-driven nations to their portfolio. They continue to receive new applications of nation states that want to be a part of the BRICS trading bloc. We have a number of different repatriation operations that have occurred between national governments, usually not out of the main pulpit, but out of the foreign ministries or the foreign secretaries or the foreign asset control departments, where they have been literally exporting and repatriating artifacts of intense and extreme value and ancestral and cultural value to various nations around the world, oftentimes, which were seized throughout colonial expeditions in the last 500 to 800 years. So all of that being said, I know I'm waxing a little bit on this question, but I'm coming back to it, I promise.
No,
all of that being said, the financial component of this drives a lot of what the deep state domestically in the United States is willing to do, what they're actually willing to press forward with, when they're actually going to push those big red buttons or not, when they're actually going to call, they're going to make that phone call and have that rogue government, attempt to launch that missile or those types of things. And we know that these, while it sounds dramatic, it's not actually hyperbole because that exact scenario occurred in 2018, and Q highlighted that and then highlighted at the end of one of the drops, this is not a game. So understanding then that the financial changeover drives a lot of what happens domestically here with those military operations in the United States, and from a deep state infiltration component, if we see a financial event prior to the election season, then no, I don't think that we're going to have any sort of standard election. I think that will be the impetus, quite frankly, for the deep state to launch an attempted 9/11 2.0 or an attempted multi-scale infiltration activation operation where terrorists and sleeper cells are activated throughout the country. This is speculative again, but this would not be out of the purview, or excuse me, out of the possibility realm for behavior of that from that opponent if they were to lose control of the money supply. We all know what happened on 9/11/2001. But if we do not see something like that occur prior to that election season, for whatever reason, because this has to be a dynamic, deliberate, tenuous process worldwide. It has to be purposeful. It has to be respectful. It has to be catered to, I think, in the highest order worldwide, so that all of the respective nations in the world, more than 200 of them, can come together and agree upon the various treatises that will outline this new financial way of life. And if we don't see that done by the November season, then I think we will make adjustments from that point forward. And perhaps those adjustments will be the NSA's direct involvement or the intelligence community at the behest of the Pentagon's direct involvement in ensuring that Trump wins again, right? They did it in 2016. We could do it again in 2024, and it could appear just as any other election. I don't think that that's the case. But if that is the case, then we will move forward, I think, from there in a constitutionally appropriate fashion that preserves above and all else preserves the excuse me, consciousness, integrity, the consciousness, consistency, and congruity in the American population, while also awakening them to the deep state bureaucracy infiltration on the other side of that election. And I apologize, Patriot. I've got, excuse me, I've had something going on because of the recent things that we've discussed off air regarding my kiddo and various events like that. So I apologize for my vocal situation.
Oh, no,
But
please, please.
all of that being said, this could go, I think, two directions. We could go in a direction where we see a 2016 2.0, where the people win again, and then we just take it to the next level, rooting out the globalist corruption within our bureaucracies, establishing culpability for criminality under COVID-19 and the various pandemic emergencies that happened. Or, and I think an avenue that is equally as possible, is that we experience an extreme national chaotic event, an extreme economic downturn that's coupled with some sort of destabilization attempt civilizationally here in the United States. And we could see patriotic forces and actors step forth in that moment to preserve the integrity of the Republic. And at that point, Patriot, we're just in simply uncharted waters that I'm not even comfortable speculating in.
Well, you know, I completely agree with you, SG, and I've been talking about the connection between the financial and, of course, domestic politics and the EBS. And I mean, the financial element of this war clearly, and you've said this on multiple occasions, that it's the most closely guarded information. These are some of the most difficult questions to answer surrounding Nasara, Jisara, the QFS, the new system. What's going to happen? What's the trigger going to be? But I certainly do agree with you that a financial event would, in terms of losing control of the monetary supply, like you just talked about, would be a massive trigger. I also wonder too, and this kind of harkens back to our previous topic, the extent to which we're watching a movie versus experiencing a fluid set of circumstances or a hybrid and anything in between. Would the imminent election of Trump be an equal trigger for the deep state, knowing that if he were to get back into office, that second scenario could play out exactly the way that you described? And then, of course, you know, I also mentioned the 500,000 sealed indictments. And I wonder if we were to see the election go forward and we were to see Trump come back into office and all of these indictments being served. I mean, we've got, I don't need to tell you how many problems that we have in terms of, you know, the border, in terms of all of these indictments that I just mentioned. I mean, we've got a huge list of problems. And what would the likelihood, or really, what would the optics be, even if all of this were to go down with Trump actually in office? You know what I'm saying? And I think that a lot of folks out there, a lot of the commentary that I've heard is centered around this notion that the crash, that whether it's a financial crash or whatever form it takes economically, this big event would have to happen under fake Biden. So, you know, I think it's a really interesting set of circumstances that we're dealing with here. But I could probably extend that and ask you some follow-ups, but I got a number of other questions here that I want to get to, and we don't have unlimited time today. So we'll put a pin in that, and then the next time we meet, certainly we'll be even closer and we'll be able to talk about that issue again. So let's kind of pivot here, and we've getting into the economic element, economics and geopolitical analysis. And typically when I have you on, we cover both. We cover the economic front and geopolitics. But as I was listening to your, I think it was your 74th audio file, right? That was the most recent one. It occurred to me that perhaps we might be able to kill two birds with one stone, as they say, by going a little bit deeper into the statement that you made regarding the Pacific Rim having direct implications on Western economic stability. And this is, in a sense, kind of a continuation of what we were just talking about. Now, clearly, there are a number of different conflicts, excuse me, going on all throughout the world, which I happen to believe are in reality quite different than what's being portrayed both on mainstream media and, quite frankly, in alternative media in certain cases. But be that as it may, there is an undeniable connection between geopolitical events and economic instability. And in this case, the ongoing eradication of cabal personnel and infrastructure is necessary in order to usher in the quantum financial system, Nasara and Jisara, whatever that's going to look like. So back to the statement that you had made, can you explain in a little bit more detail why a potential conflict between, say, Taiwan and China, we've been talking about a lot, or certainly North Korea, why would this be an impetus to accelerate the dissolution of this fiat debt prison? And perhaps you can give us a little bit more insights into that dynamic.
Well, you know, as far as the Pacific and Asiatic sector, it's really important for patriots in the Western world to understand just the type of globalist subjugation dynamics that have been at play for about 1,000, really 2,000 years at this point. The Asian, you know, sector, the Far East, if you will, of our world began its interaction with the Western, the what we would call the deep state cabalist colonial powers before the 10th and 11th centuries. And we've seen a pretty consistent subjugation process played out through infiltration of dynasties over the centuries, most recently, for example, with the dynasties of China ending in the late, or excuse me, in the early 1900s, and the emperor, I think it was Meiji that instituted the Meiji Restoration in Japan. and taking Japan away from their cultural traditional values. And a lot of that involved the transposition of their wealth, the great gold mines of China, the great gemstone mines of China and Japan, things of that nature. And so this has gone on and initially began in our modern day to feed the Industrial Revolution machine and the Western technological capabilities that were emerging in the late 18th, early 19th centuries, and then really taking off throughout the 19th and early 20th centuries. So the Western central banking fiat system owes its existence in part to and its effectiveness in part to the subjugation of the Asian world as it pertained to their resources and their monetary supply, their vast wealth that had been accumulated over centuries. And it is the Asian world, I believe, that will be driving the final nail into the vampire that has been the central banking Federal Reserve system going through this process through an expanded conflict in the Pacific region. I've talked about this on the audio files a couple of times. And I want to, and I like to tell patriots out there and remind them that this process that we're living through is about reclaiming our societies and our cultural identities, right? It's about accomplishing the culture war of reverting society, especially the societies that we have here in the West, back to what we want them to be. But that is true of all of the cultural and nation states, significant nation state players around the world. Everyone has lost something at the hands of this cabal. Therefore, everyone must have something that is culturally meaningful, symbolically impactful for them to come along to this table, or this idea of world peace moving forward on the other side just doesn't work. So the North American financial markets and the Western European financial markets are primarily responsible for the suffering of trillions over the last, 150 to 350 years, depending on how you want to age and gauge it. And yet the Asian societies have had an inordinate, I think, amount of suffering. The Asian and African societies have had an inordinate amount of suffering at the hands of that cabal, primarily due to religious and spiritual reasons that get us into bloodlines and takes us into a whole other discussion that would be a very long tangent, right? We'll put a pin in that also for the next time. But the expanded conflict that's coming in the Pacific will deal the death blow, I believe, to the North American industrial and manufacturing markets and the North American financial economy markets. So think insurance, debt versus credit, anything that's a financial component of the market society that we live in, I think is going to be affected by this. And the reason for that is because of the Asian sectors and the Asian societies, not just China, but all of the Asian nations' involvement in U.S. supply chains, U.S. logistical chains and revenue streams. And then at that nation state level, the involvement of the Chinese government in possession of U.S. Treasury bonds, the involvement of the Japanese government in financing of U.S. commercial debt, office space, things of that nature, industrial loans, et cetera. So all of that, coupled with the fact that Taiwan is the world's largest producer of semiconductors and computer chips, which are necessary in all of the Western world nations for every function of our economics situation here, right? The fact that we're having this call, for example, is made possible through microchips that were produced primarily in Taiwan and in other nations around the world, but most of them produced in Taiwan. When you add that into the fold and into this overall mixture, and you couple it with the fact that the U.S. House of Representatives in 2021, under continuity of government, passed a resolution to fast track Taiwan into the International Monetary Fund, which is now the worldwide body that is raising the alarm about the insolvency of the U.S. note, and you can see what's happening. You can see the positioning of the Western SWIFT system cabalist model for the death stroke, the death blow. And the death blow comes with the launch of hostilities in the Pacific, the shuttering of international maritime shipping lanes because of the warfare situation that I think is coming in the Pacific, and the gut punch that comes as a result of that conflict to North American markets, I don't think will be recoverable. So this is why I say earlier, when we were talking about the election situation, that I still maintain my assessment that we're not going to have a standard election model, a standard election process. I think we're going to see China move on Taiwan before the 2024 election. I think this will cause an expanded hostility situation in the Pacific region, where North Korea will also engage in hostilities against South Korea, simultaneously at the same time. I think the instability and uncertainty surrounding Japanese markets will paralyze those markets, and all of the above will result in a 1-2-3 punch to the US and Western European financial markets and model, which I think will result in a downturn in the US dollar that's not been seen in a generation, perhaps, ever, Patriot. And again, I'm not a financial advisor, but I'm simply reading the landscape of logistics, supply chains, and resources, right? These are the main considerations when you're talking about how a warfare situation is going to impact a nation state or any nation state that's party to the conflict. And I just don't see the weakness of the petrodollar with the over-leverage of the US debt system right now being able to withstand China. Potentially Russia as well being involved in these operations, and North Korea, which is a joker of a wild card if there ever was one. I just don't think these markets are going to withstand these events.
I tend to agree with you, and I certainly think that at some point the Rocket Man is going to get involved. I'm curious, do you have any quick thoughts on that? How North Korea might play a role here? Because it's very clear to see the dynamic between China and Taiwan, and certainly even the conversation about Japan and what's going on with them economically, having dumped so many of their treasury bonds so fast, and the devaluation of their currency. They've got a whole. And I think in many ways, and I don't want to veer off the topic here, but I think in many ways that's informed some of the decisions that the BRICS trade union has made. And we're going to get into that in just a moment. But, I'm curious about North Korea. You mentioned that they're a wild card, and that's undoubtedly the case. Any thoughts as to how you might war game this out, seeing North Korea getting involved in a kinetic conflict in the Pacific Rim? What role they might play? Would they be prompted by China? What do you think would be the real trigger for Kim Jong-un?
That's a really difficult question because
Sorry.
this gets into, it's okay, but it gets into the same arena that Q talked about with, having people having strings cut, people having deals that were made. We can clearly tell that Kim has pronounced to the world in multiple, excuse me, images and photographic communications that he is free of the strings. There's lots of pictures of him smiling big and brightly. With other ministers who are clearly not smiling. He began to post pictures of his sister into the international online space, which had never happened before prior to these operations. So that tells me there's a degree of confidence here. There's a degree of freedom and liberty that has been exercised here and given to Kim. And I think that happened throughout the Trump administration and the various negotiations by military forces that took place in the background. Now, the catalyst for North Korea's involvement in these broader operations, I couldn't begin to guess. It could be anything from a feather blowing in the wrong direction on the wind on a Sunday, all the way up to U.S. Military aggression in conjunction with Seoul, and we just really don't know. But what I think we do know is that if China chooses to launch a broader operation and a broader campaign on Taiwan, the Philippines will also entrench themselves in a militarized fashion and may even attempt to get involved in helping Taiwan rebuff that particular act on behalf of China. And so you could see North Korea and China sort of spearhead a reclamation operation throughout the Pacific that would destabilize the region in a very short amount of time, right? North Korea has a very large arsenal of missiles. They're very capable of getting those missiles in the air at speed, in rapid format. South Korea, of course, is right there as a proximal neighbor. Japan is not that far away. The Japanese Navy, what remains of the Japanese, Internal Defense Force Navy, could very easily be paralyzed or stopped within its tracks, right? And you could see China having such a broad land border with the Pacific Ocean right there, just within a few hundred miles of these parties that we're talking about. You could see a multi-pronged effort actually coming off of the Chinese mainland. So in this process and how it develops and how quickly these things come about, these are the uncertainties of counterintelligence warfare. These are the questions that the deep state intelligence communities currently listening to this broadcast are trying to figure out. These are the things that they don't know. And that I think is so important in this process is that Kim has a freedom that he's never had before, and he had a good relationship with President Trump. President Xi had a good relationship with President Trump. President Trump has talked about their quote friendship a number of different times, right? President Putin clearly trusted Trump quite a bit. The symbolic gesture of the ball is now in your court. That was not lost on any Western athlete, right? Or any Western audience that follows sports. And at the same time, Trump and Putin had very productive private off-book talks. So in the discussion of the landscape of what we're talking about, how North Korea may come to the table now, what role Pyongyang may still have yet to play, I think that they're sort of the chihuahua in the cage that you let loose to distract everyone from what the Rottweilers are actually doing. And how that looks and what that may actually come out to be and to play out as, I really couldn't say, Patriot, but it wouldn't surprise me if we see North Korea involved in a very loud rhetorical way, much like what was happening on Twitter during the Trump administration between Trump and Premier Kim Jong-un. From there, I'm not sure about how that would play out and how that would turn. But what I am sure of is that the situation that was described during the Trump administration, it involved missiles, it involved a lot of saber rattling, and it involved a very, sort of like almost like a Cuban Missile Crisis style event. And China and North Korea get along very well. And we know that China has also been attempting to establish military operations in Cuba, which very much heralds, the same symbolic theme as the Cuban Missile Crisis that we lived through in the 20th century. So this could go, I think, a number of different directions, Patriot, and to try and isolate what is most likely and least likely, while a great discussion, I just don't think we're going to get to a final conclusion until we have more information and more solid, factual events occurring in real time to guide those conclusions.
Absolutely. Well, I know that was a difficult question, but you're probably one of the few guests that I would be confident enough to ask a question like that. So I apologize for throwing some of these at you, but I know that you're just an incredible analyst. So I have to ask. I can't help myself. But we're talking now. We're getting into the geopolitical conversation and certainly the financial economic sphere, and we can't talk about either one, I don't think, without mentioning the BRICS trade union. And we've already done that, but it's in reality, it's not just a trade union. It's really a military, economic, and political bloc, in my view, which is continuing to expand. And of course, the central banks of all of these countries, are aggressively acquiring gold to back their currencies as they continue to innovate new protocols to essentially perform a runaround on the king dollar. And just recently, it was announced that Russia and China are settling $260 billion worth of trade this year in the ruble and the yuan without any reliance on fiat as an intermediary. And reportedly, there are, I believe, 40 more nations set to join BRICS this year or want to join. So give us your thoughts on the significance of these developments. BRICS is continuing to grow. And whether or not you believe, as I do, that what's really going on here is that the BRICS nations are covertly rolling out JSARA by spearheading this de-dollarization agenda to isolate and to ultimately take down the fiat system, the private Western central bank.
I think my overall landscape view on this particular question is that the BRICS nations are tilling the ground. The BRICS nations are setting the foundation. They're doing the first initial groundbreaking of a new system, a new way of trying to do things. And I think it's the beginning stages of what the spirit of JSARA always was, which was a world peace situation with a fair system of value exchange in all of our nations. Mm-hmm. And I think in the quantum era that we're emerging into, we would like for that to be digitally enhanced, very convenient, not providing a regression, but rather a true progression to the quality of life and the quality of spiritual actualization of humanity. Now, that being said, this is a rocky and tenuous process, right? Iraq, and not to be punny, but Iraq is a main component power in this discussion. It was the Iraqi government that remained as one of the last true gold-centric holdouts against the Federal Reserve System after the turn of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. The Iraqi government, the nation of Iraq itself sits on a conversion of a number of different electromagnetic ley lines in the world. It's sort of at the heart of the Mesopotamia of old. The Iraqi desert is placed home to a number of very ancient antiquities of humanity and very, very advanced technology projects that the CIA and the Pentagon have been studying since the early days of the Iraq takeover in 2003, 2004. So Iraq is, being offered because, like we talked about earlier, things had to be culturally meaningful for countries to come to the table. Iraq, I think, is being offered, isn't the right word, being given the role of beginning a much broader revaluation operation worldwide that will take some trickle down time into the markets. It's not going to be a market shock overnight, but I do believe that it's going to be a fairly rapid changeover relative to what the Forex markets have said about the dollar versus the dinar. And why is that significant? It's significant because what happens with Iraq and the dinar is going to ultimately impact what happens with the U.S. dollar and the fuel and energy markets worldwide. And six of the nine largest oil producing nations in the world are in the BRICS trading union. They're in the BRICS bloc, to include Iran, which has just recently rattled its own sabers with Israel. And that's, again, we'll put a pin in that for another discussion, but it's fantastically interesting as it pertains to finance. So looking then at what we have with the petrodollar landscape and the behavior of the BRICS nations, this is clearly a de-dollarization operation. They've openly admitted it at this point. But to what end, I think, is the question that everyone, sort of has on their mind. Why the de-dollarization? What's the purpose here? We know what we the people want. We the people want decentralized national currencies backed by assets in a standardized way that's fair and just, and in a truly equal fashion where we can trade across nation-state boundaries and there not be malfeasance, manipulation, and corruption. But we're also working against what those deep state opponents want. And I think that's the main reason why the financial operations of this military campaign worldwide are so very important, because the only way we the people get the type of trade and value situation, the type of financial landscape that we desire to have on the other side of this, is if that conversion process remains unadulterated. So the BRICS nations, I believe, are running actually the preparatory beta test phase of something that's much larger, Patriot, that I don't think has been truly broadcast to the public yet. At the same time, I think the BRICS nations are also having the fundamental appeal of dragging out all of those fair weather patriots or those PAY patriots who are just interested in remonetizing the same type of system in a new and different fashion, in a new and different brand. And that doesn't represent nation state sovereignty. And we've seen that actually with the behavior of some of the Western world and even some of the global South leaders that have risen to their pulpits of power in the last year and a half, as they have made sweeping financial promises about national sovereignty and the restoration of national wealth and prosperity, and yet at the same time have acted in concert with the WEF agenda or have attempted to roll out things like CBDCs, both within their own nation and even in the BRICS bloc. So you're looking, I think, at a multi-phase, multi-dimensional operation coming out of the BRICS trading bloc, where we're conducting basically the on-the-job training, the real-time research for how to make these processes work. And at the same time, we're also allowing ourselves the chance to continue to drag out, continue to neutralize and destroy true financial corruption. And it's worth noting that Iraq, which I believe has been sort of gifted that symbolic switch, if you will, to begin a reversion of the fuel markets to a true reflection of whatever their worldwide value is, it's worth noting that Iraq is not formally publicly in the BRICS bloc just yet. So this is a fascinating point in time, I think, where you're going to witness the patriotic actors in all of these different landscapes, the U.S. landscape, the Western European landscape, the BRICS nations, other regional trading blocs like the African Union. I think you're going to see patriotic actors being given the chance to really amplify their version of things. And before this is all over, Patriot, we're going to have essentially a crowd-funded, crowd-built idea of what international value exchange is all about.
Absolutely, I agree. Well, you mentioned in your response there you alluded to the end game. Like, what is the end game of this de-dollarization that the BRICS have been engaging in? And you're absolutely right. They're pretty naked about it at this point. They don't attempt to hide it at all. They're actually boasting about. And I'd mentioned that in process of asking my question, that Russia and China are boasting that they're settling all of this trade without any reliance on the dollar. So what is the end game? And this is sort of a nice segue, I think, into my next question, which has to do with optics surrounding the dollar and also a certain individual that we spoke about last time, one Javier Milei, who certainly is a proponent, at least on the surface, of maintaining the dollar as the world's reserve currency, as is Trump. And I don't think it's a stretch to say that this has been a source of confusion for a great many people out there. So I'm wondering if you could touch upon that and discuss perhaps what could be motivating. I mean, it really kind of depends upon whether or not your opinions about Milei have shifted. I remember the last time we talked, you were somewhat on the fence about this guy. But so this could be kind of two separate conversations here. What could be motivating Milei and Trump, respectively, regarding their seeming intent to want to insulate the old system as opposed to usher in its replacement?
You know, it's a difficult question to answer. And I think at the end of the day, you have to call into the fore what are the optics that each individual is having to play to within their own nation, or whether or not there are optics to consider at all, right? Optics is only true if there's a multidimensional irregular war playing
right.
out.
Right.
And we may not have that going on with individuals like Milei, but we may very well. I really don't know. What I do know is that President Trump has been very open since the very beginning of trying to return America to greatness. He's been very America first, very United States first. And I think anyone sort of standing on that pulpit, like, you can't wage an information war and completely divide your own narrative. And so for Trump to say America first, America first, America first, except for our dollar,
right?
That doesn't really hold much water, I think, with people. That being said, And this is what gives me, you know, a little bit of pause with Milei and other world leaders also. Other world leaders are not having to appeal to the American voter base, and they clearly understand from an economic standpoint what the Federal Reserve System has allowed to occur. And so open support for the U.S. dollar, you know, is that a diplomatic maneuver for, you know, an ongoing friendship with President Trump? Is Javier Milei or are other you know, heads of state taking their cues from the rhetoric of President Trump? You know, these are considerations to have. I'm not suggesting that the man is nefarious, but I am saying that it does not seem very sensible for an economist with a distinguished background and understanding how, you know, nation state economic systems function. It doesn't make much sense that this individual would be in proponent force for the U.S.-based Federal Reserve central banking slave system. That being said, there may be other political angles trying to be achieved with that. There have been recent protests in Argentina regarding actions, you know, that the Milei administration and the government is taking, primarily to cut social welfare programs. So I think everyone sort of has their own backdrop and their own landscape that they have to operate against. It is worth noting that President Trump said in 2018 that and it was at a conference with Prime Minister Abe of Japan, that we would all be on a level playing field very soon, directly as it pertained to the manipulation of currency. And President Trump was speaking expressly of China at that particular summit, but he also dropped a number of different hints throughout that very brief speech that he gave at that conference and the opening statements of that conference. He dropped a number of hints that he was also talking about the Western world, the Western financial model overall, and how there's just been a tremendous amount of injustice and unfairness that's gone in both directions throughout these economic systems. And we, of course, know on a program like this that the reason for that is because the puppeteers playing both sides of that unfairness were actually superseding the governments and profiting from both sides. So that's the broader discussion here, right? When we disempower the dollar, we disempower their ability to do what they have always been doing. We take away the clout of the Klaus Schwabs. We take away the clout of the Bill Gateses and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, right? We take away the ability of the Western financial model to bankroll and fund and spawn off criminal activity worldwide, particularly nation state level terrorism. And so for individuals like Milei or other individuals that I've seen coming out of the West African nations, Macron and others, when they're talking about, you know, we need to maintain the petrodollar standard as the world's reserve currency, I have great pause to that, because I look at the landscape from an understanding of what the petrodollar has actually done to the world from an economic sense and from a strangulation sense. And I'm not an educated economist or a law professor or a political science major. My educated background is actually in cognitive science and cognition. But when I look at these landscapes and these markets, I realize to myself that there has to be a changeover brought to the U.S. System, the U.S. North American model, and it has to occur within the currency itself. And until we disconnect the oil lifeblood from the dollar, we will never be able to transform it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Okay. Well, I have one more question related to this theater of the war, and then one final question. So I think we should have time for both. And this has to do with Zimbabwe. And we really, excuse me, we recently saw Zimbabwe roll out the ZiG, which is their gold-backed currency, which came as a shock to a great many people out there, although to some other people, they were expecting this. And this is another example in a long series of events. You mentioned Africa a little while ago, that have emanating a long series of events that are emanating from Africa that indicate, to me anyway, that both Russia and China are actively expelling Western influence from that continent. And they're effectively ending a long history of Western colonialization, another term that you brought up a little while ago, of the African continent, which has the richest deposits of natural resources in the world. And of course, taking advantage of its people in the process. So, do you have any thoughts you can offer us on what's been happening in Africa, both politically and economically, and perhaps anything related to Zimbabwe specifically?
Zimbabwe specifically is a fascinating discussion, but I don't have anything to add that you probably don't already know. The rollout of the gold-backed currency, I think a great many awakened patriots have known for a while that was coming, the revaluation of these smaller economies first, right? And then we move on up the chain to the larger players. So in a sense, it's not surprising that we're seeing that now beginning to happen. But as it pertains to the African subcontinent, and West continent overall, and really just the entirety of Africa, we've had a de-dollarization and a supporting structure operation running simultaneously at the behest of a number of different military forces throughout the world. The US military is certainly involved. The Russian and Chinese militaries are also involved. And you have various bureaucratic institutions and true charitable organizations that are not agents of evil that are also involved on the African subcontinent. And so, what has been occurring in Africa over the last few years, and really since the early days of the Trump presidency, has been a multifold mission to disconnect the impoverished and resource manipulated African economies from the US Washington, DC central banking model, allow them the chance to build up some wealth in their own right, and protect them militarily while doing so. And also allow them to disconnect their military forces from the deep state American and Western European military machine. And so this is a, as you can expect, based on what I just outlined, that's a very difficult undertaking to accomplish. And yet we have been really, progressing forward, I think, at breakneck speed throughout this process, really running an incredible pace with it, because we've got a number of nations now that are so confident in their own ability, so confident in their own security and their own self-sustainment in Africa, that for the first time ever, they are telling the USA to get the heck out. They're telling the US military to leave. They're telling Washington, D.C. to stop sending, various gifts and to cut off channels and things like that, what hasn't already been cut off at the behest of the State Department. And they're essentially telling us to go pound sand. And for the first time ever, that is bringing true liberation and true freedom to some of these nations, specifically in Central and West Africa, who have been impoverished at the hands of the British Royal Empire and the American extension of the British Crown for the last 500 to 700 years.
Right.
And it allows for the first time a true calculation of what these countries are actually worth, what kind of resources they actually have, what do the ledger books say when they're not manipulated, when they're not being cooked by a crooked administration that was backed by the US State Department, when the resources are not being sent overseas by the thousands of tons while the people starve in the streets, right? We really don't know what the African economic situation on at a continental level really truly is, because we've never had the ability to have a true gauge of it. And so now we're giving the rightful choice, the rightful decision and duty to those very countries, to those cultural and tribal groups, some of them being in control of their government and some of them just being very, very large players in the national demographic. We're giving the control to these ancestral We the People groups to attempt to assign some sort of a value to that and to be self-sustaining and self-directing for the first time in the last 500 years. And that process is cascading forward, I think, as quickly as it can go, Patriot, because we add the complicating factor to all of this in that a lot of these African nations, which have been servant to the U.S. economic model and afraid of the U.S. military, have been forced to play host to U.S. biological terrorism. So in the same sense that we're disconnecting from the U.S. slave model, we're also having to ensure that that slave model does not set off a biological event in its petulant or on its petulant way out the door, right? And so we have the Russian military, various paramilitary and militarized groups, to include formal military forces in countries like Niger and Nigeria and others. Kenya, for example, and they have been involved in essentially monitoring the expatriation of foreign powers and foreign interests from within their own nations in a safe and effective manner. And in some countries like Sudan, for example, those situations got out of control. And so they've needed more militarized handling, a firmer hand, if you will. And so, we're going through that process. It's not complete yet, and that's one of the reasons that, this ties back to that 2024 question about the election. It's one of the reasons I say this is a fluctuating situation worldwide. We're trying to accomplish these goals and these tasks in the best way possible, in the most logical and safest way for the largest amount of people. And it is just not a task that is accomplished quickly or easily, but we have to get a certain threshold. We have to achieve a certain, I think, amount of ground prior to the 2024 electoral cycle, or all of this, Patriot, is for naught.
Absolutely. All right. Well, SG, do I have time for one more question?
Indeed.
I'll try to make it an easier one. All right. Well, the last topic that I wanted to pick your brain on, and certainly I could talk to you all day long, but this is an issue that I think is important to discuss because it remains every bit as relevant, at least to the consciousness of the patriots who are listening to this right now, as it's ever been. And that is, excuse me, the scare necessary event that Q warned us about. Or told us about. And you and I, like I said, we have talked about this, but based upon our research, you and myself and many other people out there in the movement have speculated about the possibilities of what form this might take. And certainly that question remains to be answered. It's speculative. But I find it very interesting that we're now seeing the fake Biden administration leak out information to the media suggesting that he's de considering declaring a national climate emergency, which would give him the dictatorial powers necessary to perform any kind of a lockdown or to implement draconian measures to stem the flow of information, and of course, to achieve other objectives. So, what are your thoughts on the likelihood that we'll see the deep state play this card? And if they do, would you interpret that as the white hats essentially puppeteering them behind the scenes related to what we were discussing a little while ago, or would you perceive it somewhat differently?
This is a card that I talked about a little bit in the early days of the audio files, and I didn't bring it back up publicly, Patriot, because we just didn't have any significant movement or any research I could find that was corroborative enough to discuss it. But as we've looked at the pattern of behavior of that globalistic WEF tyrannical power grab agenda, and we compare that to the behavior of the Biden administration, the climate arena seems to be the next major one. It seems to be the replacement choice, if you will, for a COVID-style lockdown or some sort of cessation of public societal function, for a completely contrived and ridiculous event. And I don't count out, by the way, that that could be exacerbated or could occur concurrently with some sort of new pandemic claim coming out of the WHO, which I think anyone on this program would know would be a power grab and probably not substantiated in any true danger. So those things being said, are these the conditions in this hypothetical discussion that we're having? Are these the conditions that would unlock the law enforcement capabilities domestically of the United States military? And I would say to you, and I would submit to anyone, that the scenario we just described would be a pretty close yes. I think it would depend entirely on what actions that administration, that Manchurian agency at the top with the Biden installation, actually takes, right? Are they going to force the American population into a medical countermeasure on behalf of a climate emergency, for example? Are they going to force the removal of, you know, natural gas heat, for example, which would completely destroy the heating capability of more than half the nation? Would you see some crazy edict issued regarding cars, any cars that run on octane, any cars that take gasoline, standard gasoline fuel, which is nearly every car on the road in America, save for a very small percentage? We really don't know. But if we saw something occurring, you know, of this particular flavor and of this nature, I would not be surprised if that was the breakdown of civil society that Chris Miller, former Secretary of Defense, has described on air in a podcast as being necessary before militarized forces can engage in law enforcement functions. So in the same sense that Trump talks about how we're going to have, the largest depopulation, the largest deportation operation, in American history, you know, and at the same time, we've got the backdrop of all of these different events that are occurring, and we know that the border is going to be an important event, and we know that the Pandemic Preparedness and Response Treaty, which sells out U.S. sovereignty to the WHO and the UN, and we know that the UN is in process right now of expanding its powers in an international emergency form, and that would include climate, and they've actually outlined the word climate in that document. Right. We know that the scaffolding is being built for some sort of extraordinary sovereignty grab, a dissolution grab, I think, not only for North America and for the United States, but all of the modern Western world. And I think that's what Putin means when he comes out and he says, we don't have enemy nations. We have enemy elites. We're not at the point where it's us versus them anymore, where it's us versus us anymore. It's at the point where it's all of us versus a very concentrated select few who believe themselves to be maestros of the universe and are slow walking our Western societies, to include our great United States of America, towards this globalistic agenda where there are no personal and human rights, and the U.S. Constitution is no longer applicable. And so in that very dark example that I've just given, I think we have the light in that there are patriots within militarized forces, and there are patriots within law enforcement forces and communities, and there are patriots within the legal space, and there are patriots within the business space, and there are patriots within the financial arenas and the big power players with lots of assets, and there are patriots in all of your mom and pop communities all throughout the United States and all throughout the Western world who will not allow something like that to occur. And the military forces of the United States of America, I think they would have to know that, Patriot. And I can't imagine that if something like that occurred, we would see inertness or inactivity from those arenas, because inertness and inactivity, I think, would yield us to a true breakdown of society that would be unrecoverable. And it's on neither side's interest to allow us to arrive at that point.
Absolutely. Well, SG, this has been another great conversation. I really, really appreciate you coming back on the show. And I know that we've run a little bit over, but I always like to give my guests the opportunity just to leave us with some closing thoughts, perhaps touch upon any issue that I didn't get to tonight or that I didn't bring up. So I'm going to just throw it back over to you once again and just say hats off. You're an incredible guest. So leave us with some final words, some final thoughts, and hopefully we'll get a chance to continue our conversation that's ongoing. I absolutely love it. My audience does too in the near future.
Well, I'd be happy to continue. And, you know, it's sort of the spirit of the day we're living right now to have these pub house conversations about what a new system out from underneath this slave system of corporocracy has been for the last, you know, several hundred years. But my closing thoughts, Patriot, are typically always positive because I am actually optimistic. You know, I can spend a lot of time drilling down on how messed up things have been, on how painful and difficult things have been. But everyone sort of knows that. The reason for optimism is because we have a categorical landscape being painted for us in the background, if we're willing to look at it, which shows us that there have been good actors that have made significant moves on our behalf. And when I say on our behalf, I'm talking about we the people at the nation state level, at the international culture level. They've been making these moves attempting to destabilize the globalist agenda. And I think that destabilization is pretty much complete at this point. Regardless of what happens in the 2024 election, we could have this election completely stolen just like 2020, Patriot, and we would still not arrive at a point here in the United States where a globalist tyrannical takeover will actually be allowed. The peoples of this great nation will not stand for it. You would have open revolt. And the same is true, I think, in all of the major Western European nations, right? The French have been really spearheading and exemplifying what it means to resist their government, right? And to cause difficulty for their government because their government has caused difficulty and pain to them. And I think you're seeing that happen in its own meaningful way across those different cultural spectrums in all of those nations in Europe and in North America and in the Asian regions as well and in the African nations. So the rise of patriotism worldwide is assured, regardless of the irregular war that we're currently living in, regardless of the financial events that will come, regardless of the military events that are yet still to happen and still have to occur, regardless of the conclusion of the war in Ukraine and any expansion that may occur in Eastern Europe before that happens, the globalist agenda is forever dead. We will live to see the age where we are in an amplified nation state sovereignty system that maximizes who we are at the cultural and identity level at that national negotiation table, but also gives the heart space and the openness to everyone else at the table to be exactly who they are. And that, I think, is the truly magical portion of all of what we're going through. It's an awakening, not in a sense that the Western world is having an awakening or that the Eastern world is having an awakening. It's an awakening in the sense that the peoples of humanity across all cultural divides and ideologies are banding together under common themes, which are core to what it means to be human. And for the first time, a united voice is arising around the world that is drowning out and is going to eventually remove and destroy a very ancient evil that has sought to keep us from doing exactly that.
Beautifully said, my friend. All right. Well, thank you so much. Once again, SG Anon, ladies and gentlemen, this man is a national treasure. I'm just going to go ahead and say it. SG, you're incredible. I really am honored. Excuse me. I got caught up in my throat there a little bit. Really honored that you are a regular repeating guest on the show. I'd love to get into some other topics. Perhaps next time we can get into exopolitics a little bit and maybe some more spiritual topics. As always, I have a whole list of questions that we didn't even get to, but I know you're a very busy man, so I will bid you adieu and just thank everybody out there for listening. Hopefully you folks enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. I will be back soon with another report. God bless and Godspeed, everyone. Patriot out.